Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Who are today's teachers and what do they teach? We will talk to three contributors now to a book of optimism called Actions Speak Loudest. It's intended to reverse the pessimism in America today that says our children's generation will be the first to live less well than we do. The format is short essays by celebrities and others, followed by concrete steps that people can take in our lives to help build a better future. So with us now, the editor and two contributors to the book, who all ask questions about who teaches what in today's world in one way or another. We have Queen Noor of Jordan, who writes in this book about cross-cultural understanding, including some media angles. Nineveh Kalogeri, co-author with Dave Eggers of the book Teachers Have It Easy. She contributes to this book. And the book's editor, Robert McKinnon, who also contributes an essay about kids and screen time. So we welcome Queen Noor back to the Brian Lehrer Show, and Robert and Nineveh, welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Queen Noor, may I ask you first, you write about how frequently you see the media teach hate and negative stereotypes. What are some examples of that?
Well, I think that we've seen examples not only in so many countries. We've seen it in conflict regions throughout the world. And the United States has its own history of media having not, I think the media personalities not having been aware of the impact that stereotypes were having on minority groups in the States, whether African Americans or others, which was corrected when scientific studies showed that, in fact, negative stereotypes, humiliating stereotypes, actually have a profound impact on how we think about ourselves and how we relate to others. Our recent research that we have just done at Harvard, MIT, and the New School, looking at how media affects our own sense of identity and our relations with other groups, makes it very, very clear that those who are producing media, whether new media or more traditional media, have to become more aware of the impact that the way we tell stories, the way we convey news, has on listeners, both in the West and in other parts of the world. I have a special interest, of course, in tensions between the West and the Arab and the Muslim world right now, the impact that media has on that.
It sounds like the focus there is on professional institutions like major news organizations, but they tend to be cautious compared to many sites on the web. Is that the real problem today? Harder to control radical speech on the web, whether it's Osama bin Laden using a web video to signal a new terror attack, as people believe happened in the last day, or web audio, or anti-Muslim hate speech on other underground sites or whatever? Is that the real problem today and much harder to combat?
I think you'll find on all sides, in all cultures, that people are using media both for good and for ill. And extremists, certainly because they're loud and also looking for one another, often will find themselves, as has happened with Al-Qaeda and others, using media so effectively. But the reason that they're so effective at recruiting listeners and worse, people who will act on some of the outrageous things that they're encouraging, is because we don't have on the other side more mainstream, moderate, Muslims, Arabs, and people in the West focusing on how we can be using media to promote understanding, reconciliation, dialogue, an alternative view for those who become caught up with extremist thinking when they see no other option in front of them.
So in keeping with the methodology of this book, after the essay that you write on those themes, just to let the listeners know the context that we're dealing with here, there are boxes for what people can do, cross-cultural understanding. In my home, I can identify the similarities between American and Muslim cultures, introduce my children to positive examples of Arab-Western relationships, reject modern stereotypes, and make use of unbiased media outlets to connect my culture with others. And on that, Robert McKinnon, as editor of the book, let's take a little step back here. This book has contributors from Queen Noor to Joe Torre, Bill McKibben, the environmentalist, to Newt Gingrich. What's the goal?
Well, the goal is, you were talking about some polling earlier in a segment with Juan Williams, who's also a contributor to the book and writes the foreword. And we're often very familiar with sort of the right track, wrong track polling that we see in our country. But we don't look at other polls that take sort of a longer view. And most Americans now believe that the next generation of children will not grow up to be happier and healthier than they did. And that's pretty damning for a country like ours. So the book tries to take some of the anger that was also in that segment and say, all right, what can we do about it? Taking a look at a lot of the issues ranging from child obesity to climate change, that says, you know, these things are more connected than we think, and there are things that we can do to channel our energies in a more positive way.
Your chapter is also about media, mostly the sheer proliferation of screen time among kids, and a new Kaiser study that I mentioned before the news finds more than 7 hours a day of screen time for kids 8 to 18 in this country. That's all kinds of screen time, although interestingly, it's still more television than anything else. But I can hear teenagers the world over rolling their eyes right now at the very mention of this topic, thinking, OMG, another grown-up who doesn't get it about kid culture and relationships happening online. Why pick this topic for your own contribution to your book, which has such lofty goals?
Sure. Well, I have a specific area of expertise on that topic, having done a documentary film based on the original Kaiser study. And what was interesting to me is that issue itself permeates into so many others. If we don't give our children the right kinds of information, if we don't give them ways in which they can actually filter that information or be literate about it, then what does that say about the next generation of citizens that we're raising? And there's some very basic steps that Kaiser recommends coming out of that study, saying that maybe a child under the age of 2 shouldn't have a television in their room. Or maybe we should try to sit down and have a meal with our children without the television on. There's a scene that's described in my chapter where you have two different families, and filming them over the course of dinner. And one family's mealtime starts with the mother asking to change seats so she can actually get a better view of the television. The remote control switches hands 7 times during the course of that meal. And the entire meal lasts 11 minutes. Now, there are studies that suggest just simply having a meal with your children will improve things like education and decrease the likelihood that they'll use drugs and get into more negative kinds of behavior. So it seems like, oh, here's an adult pontificating about an issue that we should just, you know, better understand kid culture. But, you know, we're adults for a reason, and there are rules we should put in place to make sure that our kids grow up in a more responsible fashion.
And so the recommendations with your chapter are things like set clear, simple rules for family media consumption, engage our entire families and neighborhoods, and things like the annual TV turn-off week and things like that. But I'm going to challenge you one more step on this, because I tend to think, although obviously there are many, many excesses, that screen time today is much better for kids than screen time when we were kids. We just sat passively in front of a TV set. Kids today are interacting with each other on social networks. They're writing a lot in that context. They're searching for music and information. They're growing virtual cities and Sims or virtual farms and Farmville, the most popular game on Facebook. So not to diminish the importance of physical activity or getting outside or face-to-face human interaction, but maybe screen time itself is too blanket a thing to condemn in today's interactive world.
Well, I certainly think there are some forms and behaviors that are certainly much better than they were when we were growing up. But have you ever, like, watched a 2-year-old watch television and see the blank stare that sort of, you know, crowds their face?
That's depressing.
And what we're trying to say in that chapter is not to say, like, oh, you should never put your kid in front of a screen, but you should be aware of what you're doing. And so many of the issues that are captured in this book sort of speak to a lack of basic literacy about what we should be doing to deal with that issue, whether it's financial literacy, whether it's political literacy, whether it's things that, you know, you look at the current healthcare debate and how better off we would be if we actually better understood the language of the bill and the contents that we were criticizing.
We're talking with Robert McKinnon and contributors Queen Noor and Nineveh Kalaghari, contributors to the book that Robert edited, Actions Speak Loudest, Keeping Our Promise for a Better World. And Nineveh, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You write really to promote the interests of teachers, it looks like. Your essay is aimed at convincing us that teachers don't have it easy. What's your main point?
I think the larger point is that we're trying to say that the American democracy and our economic well-being and our culture really relies on teachers being excellent, and we really want to change the culture so that we don't continue to rely on this Mother Teresa model of teachers being givers and sacrificers, but really say to them, you are so very important to our democracy, and we would like to honor that, and we'd like to give you a legitimate salary, and that's part of the solution. Teacher turnover costs the country $7 billion, and I think you probably know, but 46% of teachers leave within the first 5 years, and one of the main reasons that they leave is because they can't afford to teach. And we would love to keep passionate and effective teachers in the classroom and then attract other passionate and effective people to the classroom.
And you have an interesting stat about, or set of stats about, how many teachers have second jobs to help make ends meet. But, you know, people don't take it as simple as that these days. If you came on 15 years ago and said that, it might have been a slam dunk. But right now, President Obama is trying to reform education funding so teachers get paid more based on the kids' performance on standardized tests, that teachers' unions block experimentation with charter reforms is a big issue right now, or at least topic of debate. I realize there are different points of view on that. That teachers' placement in classrooms should be based on quality, not seniority. Quality is judged by principals who have to hire to put together an effective school, things like that. So is it so simple anymore as teachers are underappreciated?
I think it is. I mean, I think that our main goal is to try and look for a teaching force that is prestigious, competitive, and financially attractive. And when we started doing really serious research, I actually was in the classroom for many years, but when we started doing serious research in salary reform as a means to change student achievement in 2003, there was not a lot going on. And gratefully, there is a lot more that's happening where people are saying, you know, we do need to compensate effective teachers, and yet a lot of the reforms aren't truly transformative. I think that there's sort of these whimpering reforms that are saying, let's make teachers show their craft, be transparent, and then pay them pretty insignificantly more.
Also, teacher pay has gone up significantly in recent years, certainly in New York City, hasn't it?
Right, and also, actually, what I was going to say is that I think that there are these shining lights of real transformation. In New York, for example, there's a school called the Equity Project, where the starting salary is $125,000.
Yeah, we had the founder on, and that's his theory, is that just for the same reason that the banks say they need to pay big salaries and big bonuses to attract people who are going to be successful, if they pay $125,000 to start to teachers, then they're going to attract a higher caliber of person. It's going to be competitive to get into his school, and then maybe even competitive to get into the whole profession if that becomes the standard, and that should be transformative for kids. You buy that model?
I completely buy it. All the research right now is pointing to the fact that the number one lever in schools is how effective the teacher is in front of the classroom, that nothing else matters as much. And I think an important point that Zeke, the founder of the Equity Project, makes is that a lot of money isn't going to turn a bad teacher into a good teacher. And there are a lot of wonderful teachers out there that aren't motivated by the money. So we want to sort of step beyond that and have an incredibly, speaking of Bob's book, have an incredibly optimistic vision of the future, where this is a job that college students stay awake at night and are desperate to get,
Is that to say that there's a crisis of mediocrity in the teaching corps now because they don't have those incentives to go into teaching?
I think that it's harsh, and I consider myself an incredibly active advocate for excellent teachers, but there are people in the classroom who don't belong there, and they should go and find something else to do, and that's true, and Arne Duncan is now articulating that, and I think we have to, you know, we do have to look at tenure, and we have to look at effectiveness. I just think that every child that walks into any American classroom should have the best person standing in front of them, and that's not the standard that we have right now overall. But that isn't to say that there aren't very effective teachers in pockets, in schools, all over the place.
Queen Noor, let me come back to you. Thank you for your patience. On your chapter on the media and hate, you know, Israeli Jews complain frequently about the hate speech, overt hate speech, that they see in Palestinian and other Arab media, including media aimed at educating children, teaching not just the politics of the Arab-Israeli conflict, and there are certainly, you know, legitimate points on the Arab side, but also hatred of Jews. How do you fight that in your country as Queen of Jordan?
Well, I think that this is, it's actually two-sided, what's taking place. There's a lot of hate speech and have some terrible crimes that have been committed as well in Israel, and there is definitely one of the areas that is so important that I was going to reference that you've just been talking about is education. And on both sides, whether it's Israeli and Palestinian and Arab, or if it's U.S. and Arab Islamic, it is terribly important that we look at the curricula, the materials that our teachers and our students are getting in schools, that we as parents and also as people who can have impact on our communities, actually seeing the tension that exists now with scientific evidence that stereotypes and half-truths and hate speech are very, very dangerous. They can lead to violence, and they can lead to conflict that spreads beyond the classroom and the community involved. So you have it on both sides, and the way to moderate extremism on all sides is to reinforce that natural understanding and trust that is possible when people learn from one another and can recognize each other's humanity.
Do you three want to talk to each other a little bit? Here you are, three contributors to this book, which has the lofty goal of trying to build a better world. It would be great to bring on other contributors to this book, Bill McKibben, Joe Torre, get you all in a room and, you know, talk about what you think might actually come out of this. But we have the three of you, Robert McKinnon, you're the editor, and Nineveh Kalogeri, and we have Queen Noor. Talk to each other. Robert, launch this.
Well, first of all, I would like to say thank you to both of our other guests today, as well as all the contributors. I think that Juan Williams, in summarizing the people in this book, say they are people who have put their hands in the muck and mire of life to make something more beautiful, a better outcome. And, I would just like to say thank you for all the work that you've done and the inspiration that you've given to so many other folks to get involved.
Well, I'd like to just comment that I think this book is somewhat unique in that it's not only essays from a diverse group of contributors, but it also, as you mentioned earlier, provides concrete suggestions, and those are just a fraction. That's just the tip of the amount of what is available in terms of resources if people want to pay attention to these issues and go look for ways in which they can make contributions that might impact the kind of world our children live in for the better.
Nineveh.
Well, I think it's just so important to really digest two separate things. I'm sorry to go back to my topic, but the two things that I think are so important to digest is that we've proven in pockets all over the country that all kids can learn, and I think that that's very, very important for Americans to really deeply digest, which is that kids, no matter what background they come from, including low-income kids, kids of every single shape, color, everything can learn. And I think knowing that and knowing the fact that the quality of the teacher in front of them is so incredibly important that it really does compel you to action. So I feel incredibly excited to be a part of this book, something that's so productive and proactive and positive, and feel very optimistic if we can ask Americans to really digest those two facts.
Can I just add, in addition to that, that what you're describing also applies to children all over the world, in every culture. And it's one of the reasons that I also, not only is education so important, but this idea of how media can bring people together to identify common ground and to begin to recognize, as I said before, each other's humanity.
Robert, how will you know if the book is successful, other than your listing on Amazon?
Well, I actually hope that the book becomes as obsolete as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, the book has become more relevant, and the goal is for it to become less so. So, you know, as we can begin to address and tackle some of the issues that are in these pages, I think that'll be the real sign of success.
By the way, Queen Nora, I've seen your picture all over the subways of New York City. I don't know how much you ride the subways of New York City, but this PBS program on genealogy that
you're gonna... I have not seen these photos. I've not been in the States for the last few months. I've been in the Middle East.
you and a number of other well-known people who whose pictures they are using to promote this. Are we going to learn about somebody you're related to in American history or something like that?
Oh, it's pretty extraordinary what Professor Gates came up with, probably on everyone. Certainly, my genealogical chart is something totally unexpected. I was very content with the thought that my family were struggling in a variety of different countries around the world, in Syria, in Sweden, in Scotland, and elsewhere, and came and to the United States for a better life. And there's some very interesting, fascinating ancestors that I never, ever would have imagined. And my children are direct descendants of the Prophet Muhammad on their father's side. And on my side, the combination actually becomes very interesting. But you'll have to watch the program.
Spoken like a true media professional. Queen Noor of Jordan, who writes in this new book about cross-cultural understanding. Nineveh Kalogeri, who writes about teachers. And the book's editor, Robert McKinnon, who also contributes an essay about screen time. The book is called Actions Speak Loudest, Keeping Our Promise for a Better World. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
It's been a privilege. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
You.